Thanks.
You're welcome.
Wouldn't be a real lecture if I didn't ask you to turn off your cell phones or buzzers. Thank you. Thank you all for coming tonight. It is a great honor to have such a wonderful group, to have all of you with us this evening to hear from a very, very special person. On behalf of my family, my wife Jill, my father Mr. Leon Wilds, who is sponsoring tonight's program, my brother, sister-in-law Michael and Amy, it is my great pleasure and honor to welcome you to the 18th annual lecture in memory of our mother Ruth Wilds, Aleha Shalom, blessed memory. This year we are honored to hear from a great Jewish leader and legal scholar, Professor Alan Dershowitz, who I want to welcome tonight, who graces us with his presence, and who I'll introduce in just a moment. I want to also acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, Chancellor of Yeshiva University, noted author and speaker Rabbi Benjamin Blech, my NJE colleagues, Rabbi Pinney, Rabbi Ezra, Rabbi Jonathan, Rabbi Avi, our fellowship class of 2013, our fusion class of 2013. And I want to especially thank my brother and my father for bringing Professor Dershowitz to us this evening. They both have had the privilege of working with the professor on some important legal cases over the years, and so it's really a special treat for our family to have you with us tonight. Before I introduce Professor Dershowitz, I'd like to say a brief word, as I do each year, about Pesel Avigal Bas Menachem, our mother, Ruth Wilds, Al HaShalom, in whose memory MJE was established and to whom this lecture each year is dedicated. Can't believe it, but this Wednesday night begins Hanukkah. And Hanukkah commemorates what I've always believed as a very misunderstood, mischaracterized holiday, perhaps. We're all familiar with the Maccabees, who fought valiantly against the Greek Syrians after they prohibited the Jews from practicing their religion. But many of us are perhaps less aware as to how much of this actually began. Hellenism was sweeping the ancient Near East. And many Jews on their own, even before the Greeks began imposing these restrictions, Jews on their own were abandoning their Jewish heritage in favor of this new philosophy. The great historian Josephus writes that the young Kohanim, the young Jewish priests, were being lured away from the temple in Jerusalem into the Greek gymnasiums. And they were going to great lengths to conceal their Jewish identity so they could be seen first and foremost as Greeks, and only afterwards as Jews. And so even before the Greeks began to impose these restrictions, we were leaving our Judaism on our own. We wanted to be accepted. So Hanukkah isn't just, they tried to kill us, we survived, let's eat. It's a little more complicated than that. And it centers around a very contemporary issue, and that is whether we, the Jewish community, wherever we live, can take part in the prevailing culture and not lose ourselves Jewishly. Hanukkah, of course, celebrates our capacity to do this, but the recent Pew study demonstrates that we are still struggling with this issue, and that's an understatement. Can we take part and contribute to the contemporary culture and still live as committed and proud Jews? My brother and I were raised in a home where the answer to that question was a resounding yes. Our mother of blessed memory, together with our father, Yibadel L'Chaim, taught us that you could be part and parcel of the secular culture in which you live and still remain Jewishly committed, and that one does not contradict the other. They sent us to Yeshiva University, where we studied Torah and Talmud alongside science, literature, and history. But we learned this lesson more so from our mother's actions and from her attitude. She was very proud of our father's success in law. But it gave her even greater nachas when my dad would incorporate some principle of American jurisprudence into our Talmud study. She always pushed us to learn together. Father would begin to nod off after a long Shabbos lunch. And my mother would nudge him, "Go learn with Mark, open up a sefer with Michael." And my father always did, because she had our greatest love and respect. And to this day, my father and I consider this a great privilege. My father and I continue to learn each and every week with each other. She wanted us to take our Judaism seriously. When she'd see me davening, or learning, or my brother running out to a Hatzalah call, she'd say the same thing: "If your grandfather could see you now." That was referring to her father, who escaped Nazi Germany, and who lived out his life as a very proud and committed Jew. But at the same time, she loved all people. And she wanted us to love everyone. And to make a difference even beyond the Jewish community. When we were younger, high school, got into a few altercations, I don't know if you could call them that, but we were mugged a few times in Queens, Forest Hills. It was a nice neighborhood, but I don't know. So most of us just sort of took it, and my brother decided to join the auxiliary police force. He walked into the 112th precinct, and he signed up. And he walked the beat 1 to 2 nights a week, all night, for about 10 years on Queens Boulevard. And my mother, Lashelle, used to stay up worrying. But on the other hand, she kind of knew that in some way she had modeled this kind of behavior. But it was an unbelievable incident. She was driving just a few blocks from the house, and she got pulled over by a police officer for running a stop sign. And while the cop was writing her the ticket, she noticed the 112th precinct pin on the officer's lapel. So with a smile, she said, "Maybe you know my son, Michael Wilds. He works for the 112th. Your son is Michael Wilds?" The officer looked back, and she answered, "Yes." And then he said, "Ma'am, can I please ask you to step out of your vehicle?" That's the story. My mother got out of the car, and then he asked, "With your permission, I'd like to give a hug to the woman who brought such a fine young man into this world." And this large Latino policeman gave my mother this huge hug. You could not have made her prouder. My father happier. He ripped off the ticket. She loved her Judaism, but she loved all people. And we were taught to appreciate other cultures as well. And she believed in being integrated in the outside world and at the same time Jewishly committed, and she did not see them as incompatible. In fact, she saw them as necessary in our world today. And so when we began MGE, we were almost 15 years old, it was clear that we would dedicate the organization to her memory. Because our goal is not only to re-engage the less affiliated into Jewish life. It is that. But it's also to demonstrate that being more Jewish doesn't have to mean being more isolated and removed. That we can be part of both. And we just finished a beautiful Shabbaton on West 86th Street. And we had close to 100 of our alumni with their children, all of whom are living this kind of life. Proud, committed Jewish lives, coming for a Shabbos. And making a difference in the world today. There are individuals that are working at some of the top law firms, hospitals, and schools. But they're now doing so from a much more Jewishly educated and committed place. And every year, thousands of young Jewish professionals are being introduced to this kind of Judaism through our Shabbat dinners, our weeknight classes, our retreats, our trips to Israel. And they're learning the same lesson. You can stay in the world, and you can be proudly Jewish at the same time. And that is why it is such an honor, and it is so appropriate to have Professor Alan Dershowitz with us this evening. Because few people have attained the level of respect and accomplishment in their professional lives and remained as proud of their Jewish roots as our speaker tonight. Professor Dershowitz is a Brooklyn native, graduate of Yale Law School, joined the Harvard Law School faculty at the age of 25. He has been called the nation's most important civil liberties lawyer and Israel's single most visible defender. He has published more than 1,000 articles in magazines, newspapers, journals, and blogs, such as the New York Times Magazine, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, the Harvard Law Review, the Yale Law Journal, Haaretz. He is the author of 30 fiction and nonfiction works for the worldwide audience, including the New York Times number one bestseller, Chutzpah, The Vanishing American Jew, The Case for Israel 1, The Case for Israel 2. Nobel laureate Elie Wiesel said of Mr. Dershowitz, and I quote, "If there had been a few people like Alan Dershowitz during the 1930s and the 1940s, the history of European Jewry might have been very different. He is a true scholar and a very proud Jew. And it is an incredible honor for us as a community and to our family to be able to host him this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Alan Dershowitz." When he came in earlier, I said, "We're really looking forward to your speech." And he said, "Oh, I didn't prepare a speech." He preferred a more informal format. So I'm going to ask, with your permission, the professor who said I can call him Alan. That's okay. Absolutely. A couple of questions. And there will be some time. Everybody can see us okay? Okay, thank you. There will be some time for your own questions as well. I can't call you Alan. Professor Dershowitz. It's a great honor. You just turned 75, Leon Hara. 50 years at Harvard. 30 published books. Can you tell us how you got here? And what influence did your Jewish education have on you?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for inviting me. It is such a great honor to be associated with the Wilds family. I go back so many years with Leon, who was one of America's great lawyers, probably America's greatest immigration lawyer, a man who almost invented the field and perfected it to a degree that has rarely been emulated. And I had the privilege many years ago, when I was a very young lawyer, nobody had ever heard of me, and Leon called me because he had a pretty important case. He was representing a young singer named John Lennon, who was about to be deported to England for some phony marijuana charge. And he asked me to help prepare the legal memoranda that would explain that the justification for his deportation wasn't particularly solid in the law. And I worked very closely with him. My fee in the case was supposed to be a signed record of the White Album. And John Lennon, in fact, signed a copy of the White Album to me, and it disappeared. Now, finally, I have both Wilds brothers under oath. Do you know where that record went? A rabbi and a lawyer, so I have to believe it actually did get lost. And I've had the privilege of working with Leon and Michael on some very important cases. One of our clients is here tonight, Kelly Rutherford, a very distinguished actor. And we're both working on different aspects of her case and seeking to achieve justice not only for her, but for her children And I'm hoping that next time you invite me back to the synagogue, we'll be able to report success. It's really a remarkable combination of elements. Rabbi, lawyer, great lawyer. I only met Ruth once or twice and had very, very fond feelings and recollections of her. And it's so wonderful that this event and the organization is devoted to her incredible memory. I also have great and fond recollections of this shul. When I was a young sophomore in high school, I was the head of the debating team. I'll tell you a story about that in a minute. And my job was to identify young, good speakers who came into the school. And one day, I was introduced to a freshman, a little kid, with thick glasses. And he came up to me and said, "I would like to join the debate team." And I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Stephen Riskin." I asked him to make a speech. And he made a pretty good speech. And I said, "You're on the debate team." The debate team had a very distinguished history. Its captain 4 years earlier had been Yitz Greenberg, and one of its most distinguished members had been Rabbi Meir Kahana, Lahavdil, I think. In any event, I picked Steve Riskin, and he always claims I started his career as, of course, one of the great public speakers and rabbinic speakers in modern history. So I feel very close connections to the Wilds family. I feel very close connections to the synagogue. So my own background, of course, I'm a product of yeshiva education, not Yeshiva University. I'll explain that in a minute. I wanted to go to yeshiva, but I think I was the first student ever turned down by Yeshiva University. I may have helped establish their admissions office, and for good reason. I was not a particularly great yeshiva student. My Rabbi Zuroff, constantly was calling my mother to school, to the point where I think a lot of my friends thought she worked there. In my new book, Taking the Stand, I've just written my autobiography after 50 years of teaching. In my autobiography, I have a photograph of my senior high school report card, my senior semester, just before college. 60 in physics with a round red circle, 60 in math with a round red circle, 65 in history, I passed, 65 in Hebrew, and an 80 in English. It really sticks in your mind. 67 average, which resulted in me being removed from the varsity basketball team, not for athletic failure, but for academic failure. Now, Rabbi Zuroff, Orthodox rabbi, called me in one day and said, "Look, Avi," that was my name, "Avi, we got to figure out what we're going to do with you. You got a good mouth, but a Yiddish cup, a Jewish brain, a good head, not so much." He said, "You've got to figure out something." Remember, this was a very Orthodox rabbi. "You have to figure out something we can do where you use your mouth but not your brain." He said, "First, you could be a conservative rabbi." He couldn't even pronounce the word reform. "Or second, you could be a lawyer." I wasn't smart enough to be a rabbi, so I had to become a lawyer. Then my history teacher called me in one day. Some of you may remember him, Mr. Loka, the nicest man in the world, a great history teacher. And I was getting 65s, and then came the Regents. And I got like a 90 on the Regents. First, he thought I cheated. Second, he called me in and said, "Look, don't let it go to your head. You're a 65 or 70 student. You've always been a 65 or 70 student. You'll always be a 65 or 70 student." And so I had a lot of trouble getting into Brooklyn College. Fortunately, there was a young guy, a math teacher, I think he was, who taught at Flatbush Yeshiva, and who also gave courses on the side. You paid $5, you can sit in the class, and he would help you take the exam to get into college. His name was, I think, Kaplan. And I took Kaplan's class, and I managed to just sneak into Brooklyn College by the skin of my teeth. And within 3 months, from June of 1955, when I was a terrible, terrible student, to September of 1955, I turned from a C-minus D student to a straight A student in college. And I still, one of the reasons I wrote my autobiography is to try to figure that out. What happened during that period of time? Well, one of the things that happened was Izzy Sherman, who's sitting right here in the second row. He was my senior counselor. I was an assistant counselor in Camp Maple Leaf that summer. And Izzy was the senior counselor. And he actually told me I was smart. Not very many people were telling me I was smart in those days. And I had a very successful summer at Camp Maple Leaf. It prepared me very well for college. It gave me a degree of self-confidence. I also went in with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. I wanted to prove to the rabbis that maybe I could do a little better than they thought. And my Jewish background and my Jewish education really has served me extraordinarily well, even though I didn't get good grades. In fact, my Hebrew grades were even worse. I remember one grade I got, it was Bein Oni minus. Bein Oni means mediocre. I couldn't even make it to mediocrity. At least I had something to aspire to. But, you know, flash forward 30 years and I wrote a book called The Genesis of Justice about Bereishit. I'm now working on a book called Abraham, the world's first, but certainly not last, Jewish lawyer. And it tells the story of Abraham Avinu, Abraham, and his argument with God over the sins of Saddam and a series of other stories that I use to generalize about the legal profession. I teach law from a very Jewish perspective. I'm not satisfied with quoting Blackstone or other Anglo-American sources in the law. I always quote the Rambam and I always quote Talmudic and Mishnaic and Midrashic sources, because I think Judaism is the oldest legal civilization in the world, and the idea of not quoting the oldest sources would just be a reflection of ignorance. I've said to my students, I've never come across a legal problem in 50 years of teaching. I also teach moral philosophy to college students, first-year college students. I've never come across a problem that the Talmudic scholars didn't at least address. I remember when I had my first big case, it involved an attempted murder. Somebody tried to kill somebody, but it turned out the man he tried to kill was already dead, but he didn't know that. What an intriguing problem. And the person who gave me the case said, there's never been a case like this. Sure enough, I found the case just like it in the Talmud. A man tried to kill somebody, but his throat had already been slit. And the Talmudic rabbis debate back and forth. And every problem I have ever had, one can find references in Jewish sources. After all, Judaism is a culture of law. You know, Rashi asks the first question, why the Bible starts with the story of creation. Why doesn't it start with the first law? And I use that very much. Now, what does it mean to say I'm a Jewish lawyer? Sandy Koufax was a Jewish pitcher, but there was nothing about his curveball that was Jewish. Maybe it had a little English, but it didn't have anything Jewish on it. What made him a Jewish lawyer? Something he didn't do. He did not pitch on Yom Kippur, and that made him a Jewish baseball player. I'm a Jewish lawyer in a very different way. I don't pick my clients based on religion or ethnicity, though I am deeply involved and have been in Soviet Jewry causes and many other Jewish causes. But when a client walks in off the street, I don't ask their ethnicity, their religion, their background. I take the case based on how important the case it is. But I do think Jewishly, and I do use the historical background of my tradition and my civilization. So I think my heritage, my background, has played an absolutely a central role. And I can't imagine having become the lawyer and the teacher and the advocate that I've become without having been brought up in Borough Park, without having had the yeshiva background. I wish I had paid more attention. I wish I had been a better student. Even wish I had been admitted to Yeshiva University. Rabbi Zurich was so committed to me not going to yeshiva, he got on the train and personally appealed to Dr. Belkin to turn me down. It didn't need a lot of appeal. All I had to do was look at my grades. But I did not get accepted to yeshiva, and I went to Brooklyn, and you know, I was very, very fortunate that I was able to use that education in this way. But my Jewish background and heritage have played a very important role.
And would you, thank you, would you say that being a Jew has hurt or helped your career? And
the answer is yes.
And maybe you could also speak to just a lot of the young aspiring Jewish professionals out there in terms of, you know, not or yes wearing our Judaism on our sleeve, showing up to an interview, sharing with them that perhaps you might have to leave a bit early on a Friday during the winter. Is that something that maybe you could speak to that?
Well, the world is such a different place than when I was at law school. When I was at law school, I was at Yale, and it was a complete meritocracy. And it didn't matter what your religion, what your heritage was. They actually listed on the bulletin board everybody's rank in the class and everybody's grades. And so everybody knew everybody else's rank. We had a name for the person who was last in the class. They were the anchor man. And those guys, it was all men. And I was fortunate. I was first in my class at Yale Law School. And then when it came to trying to get a job for the first summer, I applied to 32 Wall Street firms. And I got turned down by every one of the 32 Wall Street firms. I then applied again after my third year. At that time, I was editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. I was first in my class, and I had already gotten an offer of a clerkship at a very high level. So, you know, you'd think I'd be a desirable hire for a law firm. Again, this time, 31 out of 32, the 32nd law firm had a new antitrust head named Robert Bix, who was a Taft on one side, but unbeknownst to the firm, a Jew on the other side. And he actually offered me a job. I didn't take it, but in those days, if you were an Eastern European Jew with an obvious Jewish name, you just weren't getting job offers. So I got a job offer also from another firm named Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. Now, in those days, there were really three kinds of firms. There were the completely waspy firms, Pergath, Swain & Moore, Sullivan & Cromwell. They just wouldn't hire. You know, if your name was Lehman and you could bring in, you know, the Lehman business, okay, they'd hire you. If your name was Dershowitz from Borough Park, not so much. So there was the all waspy firms. Then there were the all Jewish firms. K. Scholer, Fearman, Hayes & Handler, Strzok & Strzok & Levin. Even they were broken down. Strzok & Strzok & Levin was mostly German Jews. K. Scholer was more Eastern European Jews. And then there were what were called the mixed firms. Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. They weren't mixed firms. They were Jewish firms with one or two non-Jews. And so I got a job for $100 a week. I still have the letter. From Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. And then I went in. I had got the job offer, but then they said, when you're in New York, come and see Simon Rifkin. Simon Rifkin, chairman of the board of the Jewish Theological Seminary, very active in the Jewish community, very prominent. He says, so, Mr. Dershowitz, I see you're going to work for me this summer. I wanted to do litigation. He was the head of litigation. I said, yeah. He said, but I noticed that it said you didn't want to work on Saturday. And I said, no, it's not a matter of didn't want to work on Saturday. It's that I'm Shabbat, you know, I'm a Sabbath observant, I'm Shomer Shabbat. He said, oh, I was not aware of that. We can't have that in this firm. You have to be available for me 7 days a week. He said, I will help you get a job at another firm, Kay Scholer, but we can't have you in our firm. If you insist on maintaining the offer, because I have the letter, we'll let you stay on for the summer, but you have no future with this firm. So, of course, I went over to Kay Scholer and worked for them. For the summer. Flash forward a few years when Justice Goldberg then retired from the Supreme Court and the UN and became a partner in Paul Weiss. The first thing he did, I told him the story, the first thing he did is he went into Simon Rifkin and said, is that story true? Rifkin said, yes, we can't have people here who don't work 7 days a week. And Goldberg said, then you can't have me. I'm not going to participate in a firm that discriminates based on religion. And you're just going to have to understand that Orthodox Jews must have the same rights as anybody else. And they changed their policy. And now, of course, there's a minion in Paul Weiss. It's a kosher kitchen. The senior partner in Sullivan & Cromwell is an Orthodox Jew. Everything has changed dramatically. That's the good news. The good news also extends to college campuses, where being a Jew is not a problem today. The single largest ethnic group, if you count Jews as an ethnic group, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants as an ethnic group, African Americans as an ethnic group, Latinos as an ethnic group, the single largest ethnic group at Harvard are Jews. The single largest ethnic group at Yale are Jews. The single largest ethnic group at many of the major Ivy League and other universities today are Jews. That's the good news. It's easy to be a Jew on a college campus today. It is not easy to be a Jewish Zionist on a college campus today. If you're overtly supportive of Israel, and let that be known, it will hurt you in your career. It will hurt you in your grades in some classes. It will hurt you in recommendations. It will hurt you in your ability to get a job. And the real heroes of this problem are the Jewish kids on college campuses who fight back, who understand that they may get hurt, but who stand up and who contradict teachers in class. And let me tell you a story about one of my students named Joel Pollack. He wanted to take a course at Harvard Law School called the Israel-Palestine Conflict. It was taught by a man named Duncan Kennedy. Duncan Kennedy's a contracts professor. Doesn't know a thing about the Middle East. Has never been in the Middle East. But he's a hard left radical. And of course, if you're a hard left radical, you have to teach a course on the Palestine-Israel conflict. And you have to teach it based on your opinion, not your knowledge. And you have to teach it from a very biased point of view. Look, who do you think teaches it at MIT? Noam Chomsky, a linguist, is teaching the course. He doesn't know anything about the Middle East, but he teaches the course because he has opinions on it. So, by the way, I don't teach a course on the Middle East conflict because I've only written 5 books on the subject and I don't regard myself as an expert. I regard myself as an advocate and I don't believe in using the classroom to indoctrinate or propagandize students. But Joel Pollack went up to the professor and said, I want to take your class, but I see the syllabus is completely biased and presents only one-sided anti-Israel propaganda. Don't you think you ought to include some of the following? And he gave him a list of books and articles that present a different perspective. And Kennedy said, no, I'm not interested in that. It's my class. I'll teach the way I want. And Joel walked right up to him and said, no, you won't. We live in the age of the Internet. I am going to put an alternative curriculum on a website, and I'm going to urge students to read the articles that I put on the website after they've read your article so they can get both sides of the issue. The teacher said, well, I can't stop you from doing that. By the end of the semester, more students were reading Joel Pollack's articles than were reading the professor's articles. And more people were believing that he was presenting a much fairer, less one-sided perspective. So students could fight back. I don't know what he got in the course. He might have gotten a terrible grade for all I know. Let me tell you who the villains are. The villains are not the Noam Chomskys and the Norman Finkelsteins. The villains are not the Gilad Atzmons, the hateful anti-Israel people. The villains are the pro-Israel professors on Columbia's campus, on NYU's campus, on Princeton's campus, on Yale's campus. The pro-Israel professors who don't have the courage of their convictions to speak out. I have no problem if an anti-Israel professor speaks out. That's his or her prerogative. But if you're a pro-Israel professor, you support an Israeli perspective, even if it's somewhat critical, and don't have the courage, you don't need courage if you're a professor with tenure. Tenure is supposed to be a reason for not needing courage. And I have to tell you, after 50 years of teaching, I have never met a less courageous group of characters than tenured professors at major universities. They are scared of their own shadows. Tenure doesn't work. It may work on the hard left. It doesn't work for the pro-Israel faculty. They're afraid that their student ratings will go down. They're afraid that they'll be less popular. They're afraid they won't get invited to do this or that. And it really, really is a shame. And the students try to press some of these professors. Every time I speak at a college, and I speak all over, why do I speak all over? I speak all over because you can't get professors to speak. I get calls every year from Columbia. There's been an anti-Israel professor, Chomsky's coming. Speak. I said, why don't you ask him? Columbia professor. None of them will speak. I said, but what about so-and-so? He's pro-Israel. Yeah, but he won't speak. What about so-and-so? She's pro-Israel. She won't speak. So they call on me to speak. So I come down and I speak. The next day, I get a phone call from one of these pro-Israel professors. Happens all the time. In a whisper. thank you so much. Thank you for speaking up. Well, why won't you speak up? Well, you know, either I'm an expert, and that means I don't want to have my expertise tarnished by advocacy, or I'm not an expert, and therefore I'm not qualified to speak about it. If everybody who's either an expert or a non-expert won't speak, who's left? And, you know, these are not people. People who are not experts on abortion speak up on that. People who are not experts on gay rights speak up on that. People who are not experts on the Middle East conflict certainly speak up on the other side. But to try to get a pro-Israel professor to open up his or her mouth has become impossible. The students put pressure on these teachers to speak, but they still won't do it. And that puts the students in a terrible position, that they have to fight these battles all by themselves. And when you do speak up, you do get in trouble. Look what happened to Larry Summers. Larry Summers spoke up in support of Israel. He said that singling out Israel, just Israel, for unique condemnation in a world where so many nations deserve more condemnation, is anti-Semitic in effect, if not in intent. And that contributed mightily to his losing his job, to the point where there was a cartoon in the Boston Globe that showed Larry Summers on his hands and knees pleading for his job back, saying, "No, no, no, you misunderstood. I didn't say women are not capable of becoming top of the profession in math. What I really said is Israel is the worst human rights country in the world. Now I'm going to have my job back." And, you know, that was a very apt cartoon. You know, professors get evaluated by the students. You read them online. I'm a very popular professor. I get 500 applicants for 15 places in my class. I still get complaints from a guy in Washington who tried twice to get into my course on legal ethics, and both times he was turned down by the computer. It wasn't my fault, President Obama. I wish I had taken you into the class, but sorry I didn't. But I'm making the point only to say I'm a popular professor. But 10% of the students every year in the evaluations who disapprove of my views on Israel give me zero rankings at every subject. So, for example, among the five things you ranked on are you boring or interesting? Well, you know, you can say a lot of negative things about me, but boring's not one of them. But I will get a zero on the boring scale from students who don't like my views on Israel. Also, accessibility outside the classroom. My wife and I have a policy of inviting every single student in our class to our home for dinner, and I have lunch with every single student in my seminar in groups of five or six. And yet I'll get zeros in accessibility outside the classroom from this group of students. Now, it doesn't hurt me, but imagine if you're a young assistant professor, or you're even a senior professor who wants to go elsewhere, or wants to get admitted to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, or wants to become, you know, more prestigious in the profession. That becomes very difficult. I'm working this weekend with my dear friends Zali and Katie Eisenstadt, who are here tonight, friends from Borough Park. Their daughter-in-law is a history professor, and she's this weekend at an association of history professors in Washington where they are trying to pass a resolution calling for the boycotting of all Israeli universities and an academic boycott against Jewish, only Jewish, Israeli professors. It excludes Arab, Muslim, Israeli professors, only Jewish Israeli professors. And I wrote a long letter in response that was circulated to the entire historical group. And I said, look, as historians, I challenge you, name a single country in the history of the world faced with threats comparable to those faced by Israel that has had a better record of human rights and a better record of compliance with the rule of law. I challenge you, here's my email, name a country. I have not gotten a single email response naming a country, because there is none. That doesn't mean Israel's perfect. It doesn't mean it can't improve. But it does mean that no country faced with comparable threats has ever been better. And to single out Israel for condemnation and boycotts and divestments and sanctions can only be explained by the fact that Israel is the Jew among nations and is being treated as the Jew among nations. So how did we respond to this? We responded in an interesting way. We put together a letter. Steve Weinberg won the Nobel Prize in Physics and is a professor at Texas, and I wrote a letter together urging professors who disagree with this boycott mechanism, urging them to identify themselves, Jewish and non-Jewish professors, to say for purposes of any anti-Israel boycott, we are Israeli academics. if you boycott Israeli academics, you are boycotting us as well, which, of course, read between the lines means we are boycotting you because we will have no associations. We got 12,000 signatories to this letter, including the presidents of major universities, including 50 or 60 Nobel Prize winners, and the message has now been made clear. If you boycott 500 or 600 or 1,000 Israeli professors, you're also boycotting some of the most prominent American professors of every religion, race, and background. So we have to fight fire with fire. We have to fight back. We can't remain silent in the face of this kind of bigotry. But the question you ask is a complex one. Yes, it's much better to be a Jew today than it was 50 years ago, but it's much worse to be an overtly Zionist supporter of Israel on a college campus and in many areas that have an academic connection. And it's much worse in Europe than it is in the United States.
What would you say is the just really focused on more of an external threat, even though we're a little a part of that too, perhaps, but what would you say is the most serious internal threat within the Jewish community today?
Well, I think there are two kinds of threats that the Jewish community has always faced. External threats to its very survival. From the very beginning of history, there have been attempts to destroy us, obviously. Pogroms, inquisitions, obviously the Shoah, was the culmination of all these threats. There have always been external threats, and there have always been internal threats. And there's a wonderful story I tell in my book, The Vanishing American Jew, about the first Lubavitcher rabbi. And the first Lubavitcher rabbi lived during the time when there was a war between France, Napoleon, and Russia. And the Jews, most of the Jews around the world, were rooting, supporting the French. Because the French said that if we come to power, we will have no religious discrimination. We all know the Tsar's policy. And it was a Rosh Hashanah service, and the Tsar and the Napoleon were in conflict. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe stood up, and he made a prayer for the Tsar, and hoping the Tsar would win. And he was asked to explain why he was flying in the face of the Jewish consensus supporting Napoleon. And he said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's pretty close, if Napoleon wins, the Jews will be wealthier, they will have more civil rights, they will be freer, but they will give up their Judaism. If the Tsar wins, the Jews will be oppressed, there will be more pogroms, but they will remain Jewish. I call this the Tsurist theory of Jewish survival. And I hope it's wrong. I hope it's wrong. It's never been tested, because we have never in our history been without external threats. The testing case would be if the external threats were finally to disappear. If one could finally look over a right shoulder and the left shoulder as a Jew and say, it's over, they've stopped oppressing us. It looked like that might have happened. In the immediate post-Second World War period, when everybody loved the Jews, everybody supported Israel, the UN helped to establish a two-state solution in the Middle East, being Jewish was not perfect in America. There was still vast discrimination in housing, in education, in employment. But the external threats were fairly minimal. And I would say right now, the external threats are greater than they were in any time since the end of the Second World War, particularly the threats posed by Iran. Iran really poses the only significant, immediate, existential threat to Israel's survival. After all, there are now 6 million Jews. It's an iconic number. Living in the state of Israel, there are now more Jews living in Israel than anywhere else on the face of the earth. And as the head of Hezbollah, who was an Iranian puppet, said some years ago, he hopes all the Jews of the world will move to Israel so they can be destroyed at once and we don't have to chase them all over the world and kill them person by person. As Elie Wiesel once said, the lesson of the Shoah for him was always believe the threats of your enemies more than the promises of your friends. And these threats have come from Iran. Prime Minister Netanyahu was wise enough and many of his advisors, and this is not a partisan issue, this is left, right in Israel, when the, quote, Arab Spring began, the leaders in Israel all said, don't jump to conclusions. We don't know how this Arab Spring will work out. Will it become an anti-Israel winter? And, of course, that has happened in some parts of the Middle East. Nobody sitting here today, you know, the Talmud said that prophecy ended with the destruction of the Second Temple, or as another prophet, Yogi Berra, once said, prediction is hard, especially about the future. And nobody can predict here today what Turkey will look like 10 years from now. Nobody can predict what Jordan will look like 10 years ago. Nobody can predict what Saudi Arabia will look like. Look, Saudi Arabia is now Israel's best friend. They want to give them landing rights so that they can use their pilots and planes to destroy the Iranian nuclear reactor. Nobody can predict what this awful neighborhood that Israel happens to find itself in will look like 20 or 30 years from now. And so the existential threats, particularly from Iran or from other countries in the area, are very, very considerable. We also face internal threats, obviously, in this organization, great organization, in this synagogue, and Yeshiva University, where Dr. Norman Lamb has transformed education and really brought such reality to the Torah Mada movement, are all confronting this incredibly difficult internal struggle that we face. And it's a very obvious struggle when you think about it. In my day, of course Jews married other Jews. Nobody else wanted to marry us. Today, everybody wants to marry a Jew, except apparently another Jew. So, you know, why are we surprised? We've eliminated the barriers of discrimination. In my day, if you were a Jew, you worked with a Jewish law firm. Who are you going to meet? You're going to meet another Jew. You work for a Jewish banking firm. Who are you going to meet? You're going to meet another Jew. And marriage is often a function of propinquity. Who you meet, who you are with. When I was growing up, nobody would imagine applying to Harvard College or Yale College. You couldn't do that. In fact, when I first went to Yale, I saw the sign, Urim V'Tumim, and I mentioned it to a friend. He said, oh yeah, that's Yale's motto. If you can read it, you can't go here. So, of course you weren't going to marry a non-Jew, because you're never going to meet a non-Jew, and if you did, they would often look down at you. You were somebody on the social scale lower than they were. That has all changed. People fall in love, and guilt and guilt aren't going to change that. And, you know, the answer to the crisis of intermarriage and of assimilation that we now face has to come from inside. My blessing to the Jewish community has always been, may the external threats disappear so that we can spend all of our time dealing with the internal threats. Because the external threats are not our fault. Anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem. It's a non-Jewish problem. Anti-Semites are the problem, not the Jews. And pogroms are not the problem. We didn't cause the pogroms. We didn't cause the Holocaust. We didn't cause the hatred toward Israel that exists in the world today. But if we fail to address the internal problems, that will be completely our fault. It's our responsibility. Who else? Who else do you blame for intermarriage? Who else do you blame for assimilation? Who else do you blame for failures of Jewish education in many parts of the country today? That's our problem. And the blessing is we should not have to worry so much about the external problem so that we can confront the internal problem and we can test the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Surah's theory of Jewish survival. It's your job. Well, let's divide our responsibilities here. It's my job to help protect the Jewish community from external threats. That's what I do. I petition, I go to Washington, I scream and I yell, I write op-eds. My job is to try to protect the Jewish community in Israel from external threats. It's your job to protect from the internal threats. That's not my area of expertise, that's your area of expertise. So we have a division of labor in many respects. And since I reject, I hope we all reject, the Tzuris theory of Jewish survival, we don't want to see increasing anti-Semitism or anti-Israel or attacks on Jews as a way of keeping the Jews together. We want to have our kosher cake and eat it too. We want to have our safety externally, and at the same time, we want to make sure that we can maintain a vibrant Jewish community. The way to do that is to make Jewish values, Jewish civilization, Jewish life so attractive to young people that it becomes unthinkable not to make it a central part of their life. The only way a Jewish young person is going to want to marry another Jew is if Judaism is so central to their life that they want to share their life with somebody who shares those values. And that's something that has to come from inside. I know this synagogue, and I know your organization, and I know many people here are devoted to that. In some respects, I'm preaching to the choir. It's not that way within some elements of the Jewish community. And the Jewish community has to be much more welcoming, much more understanding of the world in which we're living. Look, it's very easy to make sure your kid always marries a Jew. Very simple. Very simple. Move to Borough Park. Very simple to make sure your son and daughter always marries a Jew. It's very simple. Move to Borough Park. Become a chassid. Don't teach your children English. Teach them only Yiddish. Give them no education. Keep them within the community. And you'll have a 99% rate of compliance. That's very simple. There's another easy way to do it. Make aliyah. Go to Israel. Your child will almost certainly marry a Jew. Probably be an atheist. Probably be somebody who hates the Jewish, you know, community. Probably somebody who curses rabbis. But it'll be a Jew, because that's all you're going to meet in Israel. Those are the two easy alternatives. We don't accept those alternatives. We want our kids to go to Princeton. We want our kids to get jobs at Morgan Stanley. We want our kids to work at Apple and Google. And inevitably, they're going to meet people of every conceivable background. So the old system doesn't work. The system of isolation doesn't work. The system of guilt doesn't work. The system of guilt doesn't work. It has to be love. It has to be making Judaism a religion and a culture of joy, not oi. And when I grew up Orthodox in Borough Park, there was one word that rang in my ear. My grandmother's definition of Judaism could be defined with one word, maturnished. Maturnished. That word rang more loudly. I knew everything that was maturnished. Maturnished is the Yiddish word for it is forbidden. You can't do it. Maturnished. Maturnished. And marrying a non-Jew was the big M. The biggest maturnished of all. So that way doesn't work. We also have to think much more seriously about who is a Jew, how to be more welcoming, how to make sure conversion into Judaism is realistic and possible, and the old traditions of making it so impossible to convert through Orthodoxy has to be changed. But look what happens when people like Avi Weiss try to deal with that in an understanding way. Rabbi Weiss is now apparently on a blacklist by some of the chief rabbis in Israel, who don't think he's Orthodox enough to be able to certify who is a Jew. Why are they making it even harder? It's hard enough under realistic interpretations of halakha. The idea of making it even harder and not accepting what is the inevitable effect of universalization and making our children more amenable to the outside world and trying to really have Torah and Mada together, we have to be much more realistic. But I don't want to do a cop-out answer here, but I really do believe very strongly that it's my responsibility and the responsibility of Erwin Kotler, the responsibility of Elie Wiesel, the responsibility of so many of us who fight every day against the external threats that Jews face. That's our job. That's our responsibility. That's the Jewish community's responsibility. That's APAC's responsibility. But the responsibility of how to make Judaism more acceptable to young Jews is largely your responsibility, and you're doing a great job.
We're going to turn it over. Thank you. We're going to turn it over
to you to ask some questions. I want permission first, if it's okay, because we are in the business. It is our responsibility, as you've said. I'd love to be able to borrow the joy and not the oi.
But you have to attribute it to, I got it, I think, from Joseph Telishkin.
Okay.
So I have to give credit where credit is due. I wish I had thought of it first. The Tsuris theory, I thought of it. But oi joy comes from Joe Telishkin.
Okay, my brother's going to take over. Thank you.
Kelly's very upset. She may be a gossip girl, but she's not going to find a Jewish husband so quickly today.
Like, I'm not going to get a date tonight, for sure. It's like crazy.
But we can convert.
There's a rabbi waiting in the wings as we speak.
Everything is open. From OJ to Klaus von Bülow, we wanted everybody to feel comfortable this evening.
Can I tell just one funny OJ story from my book? Okay. So it's about 96, 97, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gets elected for the first time. And I've known Bibi since he's 23 years old. He was a student at MIT. My wife and my daughter and I were spending the semester in Israel. So he invited us to his office, Erev Shabbat, Friday night, when the, you know, everything closes down in Israel. And we take pictures, and it's very nice, and we schmooze. And then he says, Alan, will you excuse me, please, Carolyn and Ella? I need to talk to Alan alone. This is very, very confidential. He says, I'm taking you into my little inner office, where we have the best security, high tech, nobody can overhear us. I thought he's going to ask me about Israel security. He puts his arm around me and says, so, Alan, did OJ do it? I said, Mr. Prime Minister, does Israel have nuclear weapons? He said, you know I can't tell you that. I said,
okay. Questions, please. Bring a microphone.
Thank you, Professor Berkowitz, for speaking to us. And also thank you for your book, The Case for Israel. That really, I think for me anyway, helped me get through college. I went to Colorado College, and for September 11th, they brought Hanan Ashbari to commemorate the occasion. So thank you for that. But now, a lot of my friends, Jewish friends, are marrying out, and I think we need a new book from you, The Case for Staying Jewish. And I realize you just said that's not your expertise, so my question for you is maybe you and Rabbi Wiles can get together and read that book for us. We're really interested in that.
I wrote a sequel called The Vanishing American Jew, which I deal with some of these problems, and I do propose...
In 96, I read
that. Some possible ways of addressing the problem, but the way I primarily address is to just to make Judaism much more adaptive and attractive to young people. And I think there are so many groups that are doing this. I can just tell you that at Harvard now, we have such an eclectic approach to Judaism. On the one hand, we have Chabad, which is at Harvard a very modern place, asks no questions. Kids come on motorcycles with tattoos, and for a Friday night dinner, nobody asks any questions about level of religiosity. They're just there to get a little bit of spiritual uplifting. There's Hillel. There are three or four different Orthodox minyanim. There are conservative minyanim, reform. There's even an atheist group called the Jewish Humanist Society. And the Jewish God, the God they don't believe in is the Jewish God. So it's very important.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Professor Dershowitz. Two quick questions. First, I don't recall when I was at the law school if there was any classes on Torah and Talmud, but when I started studying Torah and Talmud 5 or 6 years ago, I was shocked to discover it's not just don't eat shrimp, don't eat pork, don't drive on Shabbos. It's a complete civil code, a complete criminal code. Is there, two quick questions, are there anything at the law school now, and if not, should there be, about, from a religious legal standpoint, Torah and Talmud? And the second question, which I have to ask you, is can we get a few thoughts from you on the current Snowden NSA matter?
Okay, sure. First one, let me answer about Harvard. We have many, many courses on the law in Talmud. We have a Gross Professorship, which is filled every year with a Talmudic scholar, often from Israel, sometimes from Cardozo Law School. We had Suzanne Stone one year. We've had various people, as I said, from Israel. We had Menachem Elon, who taught a course on Mishpat Ivri, Hebrew Law. I taught a course many, many years ago with Shlomo Sternberg on law and Talmud, comparing how the Talmud and the law use probabilities and mathematical material. I also taught a course called The Scriptural Sources of Justice, where my star student was Samantha Power, who cut class frequently to go to the former Yugoslavia and write about genocide. But she was a great student. And, you know, those courses attract students of every religious background. And so we do have quite a number of classes. They're not taught from a religious perspective, obviously. They're taught from an academic perspective. As far as the Snowden is concerned, I'll just give you a very brief answer because it's not the subject of tonight's talk. There are two levels. First of all, I represent Julian Assange, so I'm not without bias in this regard. And there are two levels. On the one hand, but I'm not speaking for Assange, he doesn't agree with this analysis at all. On the one hand, there are the people who stole the secrets. Daniel Ellsberg, he stole secrets he was not entitled to. He had made a pledge to keep secrets, and he didn't. He should have and could have gone to jail. Maybe he was a civil disobedient and a whistleblower. That's for philosophers and historians to determine. Legally, what he did was a crime. The same thing is true with Bradley Manning. He stole material from the United States government that he was not entitled to have access to. The United States is entitled to keep secrets. Not all secrets, not everything that's classified, but we're entitled not to have the names of our spies, the locations of safe houses, our nuclear codes revealed. And then there's Snowden. And Snowden, too, stole secrets that he was obligated to keep. That's one level. At the second level are those people who published the material, the New York Times, the Washington Post, in the Dan Ellsberg case, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and WikiLeaks in the case of Manning, and the National, the Guardian newspaper in London, Manchester, but in London, that published the Snowden leaks. They're protected by the First Amendment, but the people who got the material are not protected by the First Amendment. Look, I think what Snowden did revealed some pretty awful activities by the NSA. They over-classify, they over-intrude. There's much too much. We have to strike an appropriate balance. In my book, I have a whole chapter about how difficult it is to strike the balance between freedom of speech and national security. But it's a balance that has to be struck in every democracy. We do it better than most. Both England and Israel have state secret acts. There's a wonderful story one day that Natan Sharansky told me when I was representing him. He told me that a guy was arrested in the Soviet Union for calling Stalin a jerk. And he came in front of the court and said, the documents said, I'm here to prove that Stalin is, in fact, a jerk. And they said, no, you can't do that. You haven't been charged with defamation. You've been charged with revealing a state secret. And I think much of what is classified today is simply ways of protecting jerks in government from their jerkiness being revealed. And so there's much too much classification. But on the other hand, that has to be fought legally and not extra-legally.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much. I actually was a student of yours in 2005.
I can't see your face. Wait a minute.
Robbie Berman.
Oh, hi. Nice to see you. Good. I hope I gave you a good grade.
Well, I want to thank you for tonight because it's nice to know that I took your class in ethics and law, so I actually got into a class that Barack Obama was not allowed
to. That's
into.
Right.
It's my ego. There are many people that you represent that many people think are guilty, and they criticize you, such as O.J. People think he's guilty, and they criticize you for representing him. But there are people that you haven't represented, so I want them to know what your bright lines were for defending somebody.
Well, first of all, most of the people I represent in criminal cases are probably guilty. Thank God for that. Would anybody want to live in a country where the majority of people charged with crime are innocent? That might be China, Iran, in America, you know, certainly 80, 90% of people who are charged with crime are guilty. By the time they come to me, they've been convicted already because I'm an appellate lawyer, so probably a large percentage of my clients have been guilty. You know, the sinners of Saddam were guilty too, and Abraham pointed his finger to God and said, Khalil alakha hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. How far, you know, the Bible translates that as far be it from you, but any of you who know Hebrew know Khalil, it doesn't mean far be it. It means it would be profane of you and kosher of you. A really horrible phrase to direct at a God if you were to sweep away the guilty along the innocent. And Abraham doesn't ask him just to free the guilty, but he asks him to spare the innocent on behalf of the guilty. And you all know the argument. He gets him down to 10 and then goes back to his place. I'm inspired by that story. For me, the way to make sure that we keep our system where only or mostly the guilty are prosecuted is for zealous, vigorous lawyers to defend people whether they're guilty or innocent. So I have several criteria in taking cases. Guilt or innocence is not one of them. I do not take cases of people who are going to be in a position to continue to commit ongoing crimes. People who are in the criminal professions. I don't represent mafiosos. I don't represent professional drug dealers. I don't represent pimps. I don't represent terrorists. Though I'm asked often. Just this week, I was called by the uncle and father of the underwear bomber to review his case and to examine it to see if there were any miscarriages of justice. I was recently called by former Prime Minister Musharraf of Pakistan to review his case. He's being charged with murder. I did represent the president of the Ukraine, Kuchma, and won an acquittal for him in his case. My grandmother would be so, I don't know, ambivalent. I'm representing the president of the Ukraine, which still has on its $5 bill, by the way, a picture of Khmelnytsky, the man who massacred 100,000 Jews. And I was asked by Mubarak and the Mubarak family to represent them, and also by the family of the Libyan dictator Gaddafi to represent them. They just like Jewish lawyers somehow.
I didn't let him sleep at any time.
All right. There's a big difference. I wouldn't shake their hands, but I would represent them. And you know, I feel like a doctor or a priest. A priest will give a confession to somebody who they believe is guilty, and a doctor will perform surgery on somebody who has done terrible things. My job is to defend the guilty and the innocent alike with the rules that I've set out. I've been very fortunate. I've never had a client who I've had 37 homicide cases, and I've won more than 30 of them using mostly science. And I've never had somebody commit a murder after I've gotten them acquitted. I'll tell you, I told before, we had a little session before, I told them a funny story. I'll repeat the story here. This sounds like the beginning of a really bad joke, but Anatoly Sharansky, Vaclav Havel, Mikhail Gorbachev, and Alan Dershowitz walk into an elevator. Absolutely true. It happened in the Inbal Hotel in Jerusalem in 2008 at Israel's 60th anniversary. We were all there to speak. And Gorbachev looks around, he sees me, recognizes me, recognizes my two clients. I had represented Vaclav Havel when he was a dissident. And he says, the big shot lawyer, the guy who claims he got these two guys out of prison. And of course, immediately Vaclav Havel said, he did get us out of prison. And Gorbachev said, no, I got you out of prison. And then Sharansky said, but if you got us out of prison, why didn't you get us out of me sooner? And Gorbachev says, that powerful I never was. So, you know, you represent, sometimes you like your clients, sometimes you don't. That's not your job. I don't socialize with my clients. It's criminal cases. Obviously, when I'm dealing in civil cases, when I'm dealing with problems involving children or parenting or immigration, I can become friendly with my clients. But in criminal cases, you have to build a wall, and you have to know that you're engaged in a professional capacity.
Hi, thank you. Hi. Given the opportunity, would you take the chance to advocate on behalf of Jonathan Pollard?
Given the opportunity, I've been advocating on behalf of Jonathan Pollard since 2 weeks after he was sentenced. I wrote the first op-ed piece in the New York Times condemning the sentence. I had an enormous fight in the Anti-Defamation League, who refused to speak up on behalf of Pollard back in the 1980s. I've spoken to every single president since the time Pollard was convicted, seeking his release. He never should have been sentenced to more than a small sentence. He made a plea bargain. The plea bargain was in exchange for not contesting the charges and for cooperating fully. He would not get life imprisonment, but he would get a sentence of years comparable to those received by others who spied for allies. The United States broke its plea bargain. The United States submitted an affidavit, a perjured affidavit, by Caspar Weinberger, seeking life imprisonment, even though the United States had bargained that it would not seek life imprisonment. The judge then imposed life imprisonment. We came very, very, very close with Clinton. Clinton wanted to commute the sentence of Jonathan Pollard. He had kind of made an implicit commitment that he would do it to Benjamin Netanyahu at the Y conference. And you know who talked him out of it? Joe Lieberman. You know who talked him out of it? 8 Jewish United States senators. How do I know that? Because Bill Clinton told me. And he showed me the letters that were written by 8 Jewish United States senators urging him not to commute the sentence. And Bill Clinton said to me personally, Alan, how can you ask me to put my credibility on the line when you can't even get your ducks in line and get your Jewish senators to support a commutation? And so point the finger of accusation where it should be pointed. It involves some of our favorite senators, some of our most pro-Israel senators. I think their view is they didn't want to be accused of dual loyalty. They had bigger fish to fry. They wanted to maintain strong advocacy on behalf of Israel. But on the issue of Jonathan Pollard, there's a lot of explaining to do, as Lucy used to say. A lot of explaining to do on behalf of some American Jewish leaders. Yeah.
Professor, tell us a little bit about the Clinton relationship that you enjoy. If Hillary is likely to be a president of this nation, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've known the Clintons for a long time. Bill Clinton was elected. Well, first, I'll tell you a funny story about how a Harvard professor changed history. By the way, a lot of these stories are vignettes from my book. So
available on Amazon.
This is a good story, though. It starts with the fact that Bill and Hillary Clinton came to Martha's Vineyard the first year that he was president. And I knew him, so I invited him to come to shul. It was early Rosh Hashanah that year. So we were having services, and I invited him and Hillary to come to shul, and they accepted and became the first president ever to come to Rosh Hashanah services, sat next to us. I taught him how to sing some of the songs. I went with the piano and taught him some of the melodies. He's very quick. He picks them up very quickly, and he sang some of the melodies. It was really, really nice. And then he invited us to dinner. I had had Rosh Hashanah dinner already before, but because we had, it was a late service. So I had my second meal with him. And during the course of the meal, I said, Hillary, how come you went to Yale Law School, not Harvard? And she said, well, Harvard didn't want me. I said, what do you mean Harvard didn't want me? She said, they turned you down. No, they accepted me. She was at Wellesley at the time. And she said, I had a letter of admission from Harvard and a letter of admission from Yale, and I went to a Lincoln's Inn Christmas dance and with my then-boyfriend, now Bill Clinton, and I showed the letters to a professor at Harvard Law School who was there at the dance, and I said, where do you think I should go? And he said, well, we have about as many women as we need at Harvard. Yale is much more suited to the intellectual capacities of women. You should go there. And she did. And she met Bill. And if she had not gone to Yale and met Bill, he never would have been president. So, you know, I've had a good relationship with both Bill and Hillary. That doesn't mean I agree with them about everything. Bill Clinton, I can tell you, has the deepest feelings of love for Israel. Really, really deep in his heart. The two presidents, that three presidents that I know who have the strongest emotional attachments to Israel are the most recent George W. Bush Jr. president, President Clinton, and Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson had incredible love for Israel and for the Jewish people. Very, very underrated, and not too many people know how much he admired Israel and what he did to help Israel develop its nuclear program and other kinds of defenses. He really
was much, much better on Israel than his predecessor was, and the people who succeeded him were. And I think Hillary Clinton represents a somewhat different generation on the Israel thing. I think she's supportive of Israel. She was a good United States senator. I'm not taking any positions on any future candidates, and this wouldn't be the time to do that. But you know, I think Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, are pro-Israel. Every American president has been in conflict with Israel about issues. There's never been a presidency which has been a completely smooth sailing, even Lyndon Johnson. I remember once having a conversation with Bill Clinton in which he said, "It's so hard to deal with Israel." He said, "It's so easy to deal with Jordan. You just call the king and he has to do it. You tell him because he's the king and, you know, we'll cut off aid. If you don't like what Egypt's doing, you call Mubarak. He's the dictator. If you don't like what Israel's doing, there's no one to call." It's a democracy, damn it. He was absolutely right. And I have to tell you, I told that story to Barack Obama and said to him, "Mr. President, you're not approaching Israel in the right way. You have to go to Israel. And you have to speak to the Israeli people. You have to have a heart-to-heart with them." Because at that point, his numbers were very, very low in Israel, as they are again now. But they were very, very low. And as you may remember, he went to Israel and did get on television, speak to the Israeli people, and got a lot of increased support. If you want to deal with Israel, you have to persuade the Israeli people. It is a democracy, damn it, for better or worse. And that's the reality.
Sure.
First off, thank you for coming. Question, what advice would you give to the younger Jewish Zionist generation who has to deal with the social and career consequences of advocating for Israel?
Just keep fighting and always have the facts on your side. When the enemies talk about the Nakba, the catastrophe, remind them how the Nakba began. Remind them that the United Nations offered a two-state solution, allowing a Palestinian state in what would be 60% of the arable land, with 40% of it going to Israel. Of course, Israel got the Negev, which everybody thought was a useless piece of property. Remember that it was the Palestinians and the Arabs who attacked Israel in a genocidal war, and that's what caused the so-called Nakba. It was a self-inflicted wound. Always have the facts. Always make sure you understand all the issues. Don't fight back against their emotion with emotion. Always respond with better facts and facts that represent consensus by historians, and just never give up. You've got to keep fighting. It's very hard, and you'll hear lie after lie after lie. For me, it's just appalling. I went to Brooklyn College. I'm very proud of Brooklyn College. I just donated all my papers to Brooklyn College. On the other hand, Brooklyn College Political Science Department has now twice sponsored a very anti-Israel events. That's the Political Science Department sponsoring these events. Departments shouldn't be sponsoring controversial events like this. The Political Science Department has never invited me to speak about Israel, even though, you know, I'm certainly among their more distinguished alum, and they invite only anti-Israel speakers. The same thing has been true with other departments at the university as well. And so I have spoken to President Gould of Brooklyn College and other alumni, have let her know our views. I'm not against speakers speaking from every point of view. Brooklyn College shouldn't be censoring, but it shouldn't be endorsing. And departmental endorsement sends a terrible message to the students. It sends a message to the students that this department takes a position on the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and it's a position that, if you oppose, might affect your future in the department. That's not the right message to send.
Sir. Professor Dershowitz, you just mentioned this awful story of 8 Jewish senators undermining. But there's no mystery about Jews being our own worst enemy. You spoke earlier about J Street and what it's doing to Israel. What is our response? How does outreach work? How does outreach get involved in the response to Jewish undermining of ourselves?
It's a very, very important question. J Street is a perfect example. J Street speaks out of two sides of its mouth. When it wants to recruit students on college campuses, it pretends to be a moderate organization that simply opposes Israel's policy on settlements. It often will quote people like me who have been critical of some of Israel's policy on the settlements. And if J Street had just limited itself to criticizing some of Israeli policies, I would have no problem. But J Street has undermined Israel repeatedly. When the United States vetoed a Security Council resolution condemning Israel, a one-sided resolution, J Street opposed that and wanted the United States to vote to condemn Israel. You can't be pro-Israel and ask the United States to vote to condemn Israel at the UN. You can't be pro-Israel and support the Goldstone Report, which was a pack of lies, a blood libel, and something that even Goldstone has now renounced. J Street did that. You can't be pro-Israel and accept your founding money from George Soros, who was clearly anti-Israel. You can't be pro-Israel and be founded by a co-founder, along with Jeremy Ben-Ami, the co-founder, who said Israel's creation may well have been a mistake. You can't be pro-Israel and be opposed to keeping the military option on the table against Iran. Every Israeli wants to keep the military option on the table as a last resort, to be sure. But then, in a policy paper, Meir Dagan and Ephraim Halevi, both of whom I know, were quoted by J Street as taking the military option off the table. I called them both on the phone that very day and said, are you in favor of taking the military option off the table? Absolutely not. The military option must be kept on the table, but J Street is quoting them to take it off the table. And now J Street wants to reduce sanctions and undercut again what is a wide consensus in Israel. Almost nobody in Israel today wants to reduce sanctions and wants to take the military option off the table. So it's and what happens is they speak the voice of centrism when they want to recruit students from college campuses, but then when they want to get the hard left, when they want to expand their base way, way, way leftward, they speak the speech of DBS, divestment, boycott, sanctions. They have speakers that favor divestment, boycott, sanctions. They try to be all things to all people. That's why I have issued a challenge over and over again to J Street. Invite me to speak at your next national conference. Let me tell your people from the center what the left is saying. Let me tell the people from the left what the center is saying. They will not allow me into their building because they know that I will speak the truth and not allow them to speak out of two sides of their mouth. So we have a real problem with J Street. We have a real problem with Voices for Peace, which doesn't advocate peace and is a very anti-Israel organization. They have a wonderful name. I would join an organization called Voices for Peace in a minute, but that's not their true aim. And so it's very hard because we have to have a big tent and we have to be very inclusive. Particularly Hillel on college campuses has to be very inclusive. It has to welcome anybody who wants to be associated with a Jewish organization. But we have to make sure that people know what the truth is. You know, the motto of Brandeis University is MF, truth. Harvard is Veritas, truth. That's our answer. We always have to have the truth on our side, and we have to have credibility.
Last question.
Hi, my name is Ori. Thank you for speaking today. And speaking about, you know, these organizations on campus, I attended school at UCSD and, you know, was arguing against Students for Justice in Palestine and Muslim student associations that were popping up. And it was interesting to see how these students would use, I would say, fallacious arguments to trap you into a moral thinking pathway to kind of get you into their camp. I know that you also teach a moral philosophy class, and I was wondering, in comparing a secular approach to morality, the Jewish approach to morality, where do you find resonance, where do you find dissonance, and how do you bridge the two?
Well, you know, Judaism is a civilization, and civilizations have a wide variety of voices. I always get suspicious when somebody says, the Jewish approach is. There is no Jewish approach to liberalism versus conservatism. There is no Jewish approach to being a Republican or a Democrat. There is no Jewish approach to a wide range of broad issues. There are Jewish approaches. There are many voices. There have always been conservative voices within the Jewish community. There have always been liberal voices. Unfortunately, there have also been radical voices and extremely right-wing voices. we are a multifaceted civilization. You know the old joke, you know, two Jews, three opinions. You know, six Israelis, 12 newspapers. Don't expect and there to be consensus. And, you know, people are wrong when they say criticism of Israeli policies is anti-Semitism. It's not. If criticism of Israeli policies, the policies of the current Israeli government, were anti-Semitism, then, of course, the greatest concentration of anti-Semites in the world would be in Tel Aviv. The Haaretz would be regarded as an anti-Semitic newspaper. It's not. And Tel Aviv represents a wide diversity of viewpoints. So there shouldn't be any surprise there. There are, however, points of Jewish consensus. One of the reasons that I think my book, The Case for Israel, had some positive impact is I tried to make the 80% case. I try to make the case that stays away from those areas that Jews are divided about. In the back of my book, The Case for Peace, I got Amos Oz to sign, and I got Ariel Sharon. Now, these guys don't agree about anything, but they agreed with my plan on the book because I tried to stay away from the divisive issues. The difference between me and J Street is J Street focuses on the 20% that divides the Jewish community. I try to focus on the 80% that unites it. Now, in a private conversation, I'll tell you about my disagreements with current Israeli government policies. And there are some, and there are some that are substantial. But the point of view is to try to present a concerted effort. Before we were talking, I was reminded by one of my friends out there about the last time Jews were together on an issue. The last time. And that was the Soviet Jewry movement. We stood together in the Soviet Jewry movement as one. It was the most successful human rights movement in modern history. We managed to rescue over 1 million Jews from a fate that was so horrible. I went to the Soviet Union so many times as a result of requests by Joseph Lipstein and the various modern Orthodox movements here, Mel Stein and others who sent me and Telford Taylor and others to the Soviet Union. We stood together as one. There weren't really dissenting groups within the Soviet Jewry movement. It was very important. Let me mention one other point about Soviet Jewry that maybe you hadn't thought of. People complain all the time on college campuses that Israel has now moved somewhat to the right politically. And a new book by Ari Shavet makes that point. Other new books make that point. Nobody asks the question why. It's true. Israel has moved somewhat to the right. And there are two fundamental reasons why. Number one, Arafat's rejection of the Camp David peace plan in 2000 and 2001, which was the most generous peace plan ever proposed by a victorious country to end an occupation. That's why I always refer to Yasser Arafat's death as this untimely death. If he had only died 4 years earlier, we might have had peace and the acceptance of the Camp David Accords. And the second reason why Israel has moved to the right, and I had this debate with Peter Beinhart recently. Peter Beinhart started by saying, Alan, I admire you so much. You did so much work for Soviet Jewry. I grew up on Soviet Jewry. That was the greatest movement. But why do you support Israel, a country that's turned to the right? And I said, Peter, do you not understand the contradiction of what you're saying? The reason Israel has turned to the right is because we brought 1 million Soviet Jews into Israel. And Soviet Jews are very anti-communist and very anti-left. They have lived under the oppression of the left. So what do you want us to do, Peter? You want us to send them back to Russia? What do you want us to do? You want to deny them the right to vote? Israel is a democracy. And when you bring 1 million people in who have different views from your own, those views will change Israeli policies. So my answer is, Peter, go to Israel. Talk to the Russians. Persuade them of your point of view. Turn them into left-wing Beinhartians. But don't complain about Israel's policies because they're a function of Israeli democracy, which is a function of Zionism, which is a function of bringing Soviet Jews from outside into Israel, making Aliyah. It's complicated. It's nuanced. And my great fear is the debate over the Middle East today lacks nuance. It lacks it on the left, it lacks it on the right, it even lacks it on the center. Nuance is our friend. Facts are our friend. We have the right on our side. We are mostly on the side of justice. And if we only can get the case presented more effectively, more articulately, more honestly, I believe more people will come and support our views. So, with great thanks to the Wilds family and to this wonderful synagogue and to all of you who are coming here tonight, I want to leave on a note of optimism. I see young people out here today. You're all anxious to do the right thing. It's not so easy to determine exactly what the right thing is all the time. But the quest for the right thing is more important than the answer. The quest is there. We all want to do the right thing. May you all go from strength to strength. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's been 18 years since our dear mother passed. I want to thank the distinguished rabbis and family friends and new clients, our co-client, who worked on the other issue, for coming here this evening. A modern-day Joseph just spoke to us, biblical viceroy that we read in the Torah today, known for his scholarship, his vision, his advocacy, and his stewardship, principles that were the stock in trade of the household that my brother and I grew up in, making it strikingly easy for a gentleman like me to run for mayor, thank you for your check, by the way, at the time successfully, and to now be a professor of law for 3 years at Cardozo, following my father's 33 years. Renaissance men, Leon Wilds, Alan Dershowitz, the stock of Abraham, as George Washington wrote to that infant Jewish community in Rhode Island, in Newport. The very venerable stock that my brother hails from. 18 years ago, a candle dimmed in our household. The beautiful warmth and love of that expansive table that knew some strangers. The generosity of public spirit was patently part of our profession, and our wives, thank God, have hailed that call too. My brother once related to me that we are the people of Israel, not Abraham or Isaac, because Yisrael Yaakov was the only one identified in the Bible with a relationship with his grandchildren when he crossed his hands. You only have to spend a few minutes with one of the 8 grandchildren of my parents to know that that DNA transferred itself and that they have done their job. Have we done our job? I regard my brother extraordinarily because I think the truest legacy of our mother is the bond that we have with each other. The breadth of his scholarship and the genuineness of his soul to dedicate his life to the stock of Abraham is something that we need, and it's something that we can't take for granted. As the next generation goes forward, as we face challenges in this nation and our people abroad, we need help. MJE cannot do it on a $20 contribution this evening. And if you want to multiply this gentleman and to make sure that this room is exponential, then come back and support and do everything that you can. Last year's speaker, Rabbi Sachs, we had the privilege of getting him a visa to come and teach here. He seemed to have a citizenship, so he can't be a client. Spoke with such eloquence. And we have 18 years worth of Torah and scholarship and secular leaders who have spoken here. It's really time for us to expand this beautiful tent, and I urge everybody to dig in a little deep so it hurts a little bit, so that my brother can be calling you back next year to an even greater forum. We wish you all a wonderful Hanukkah. We hope that you'll join us for a little convocation, and we thank this extraordinary speaker for his gift and his presence today.